everybody to the 12th episode of Purpose Driven Law. I can't believe recording episode 12 earlier this year. The show was just a dream in my notebook. So this is very cool, especially to have guests like Larry Cohen on the show. And Mr. Cohen is a partner at Saltzmann Bluesy and Vendesky and chairs the firm's mass tort and toxic tort department. And if you don't know who Mr. Cohen is, he doesn't really need much of an introduction, because if you're in the legal space, you really know the reputation that he has and the involvements that he's had on torts like PFAS litigation, paraquat, talc, benzene. Their firm leads also in Camp Lejeune and many other dangerous product and medical malpractice fields. But the thing that really entices me and makes me excited that Larry is on the show today is that he also specializes in vaccine laws. So those are some of the things that we'll be discussing on the show. But a lot of things that people don't know about Larry is not only is he a yogi, but he also used to be in Boy Scouts. And that's really where his dream or inspirations blossomed to become an attorney. So why don't you take us through that experience from your days in Boy Scouts and how that has blossomed your journey to be where you are today?
I will. Thank you, Amy, for that wonderful introduction. And I don't think I've ever had an interview or a discussion in my legal career where it has begun with my background in the Boy Scouts. So thank you for asking about that.
You're welcome.
That it came up. It is really the root of what motivates me in my practice and as a person. I was fortunate in that my father was an outdoorsman. He loved camping. He loved taking all of his kids out. He became the scoutmaster of a local Boy Scout troop, and I joined. I eventually became an Eagle Scout, but we camped everywhere. We did every kind of outdoor activity you could imagine. I learned to appreciate and respect nature. I became an avid environmentalist. And that was through all of those years, spending time in the outdoors, seeing damage that was done, learning about pollution, learning how to respect the environment. And that's where it began for me. Obviously, from there, I went to college and law school. And you want me to continue on there? And I was bringing that with me. When I went to law school, I did have a vision of becoming an environmental lawyer. And I became at Penn Law here in Philadelphia, the president of the environmental law group. We had our own journal, and it was a group or an organization with about 40 students in the school. And we did research and writing on environmental issues. I have a fantastic story about that, which probably is what catapulted me into my practice as a lawyer. Would you like to hear that as well?
Yes, I was just about to ask. Please share.
So I'm dating myself because I'm going way back to the Three Mile Island disaster, which many don't know about unless they were around back then. But a little over 40 years ago, here in Pennsylvania, there was a nuclear power plant called Three Mile Island. And Three Mile Island had a disaster. They had a meltdown. They had a huge radiation leak. The farms, it was in central to western Pennsylvania, the farms were all contaminated in that area. Homes were contaminated. Individuals were exposed. They shut down the plant. Was the first nuclear power plant disaster in America, one of the first on the planet. And there was a big push all across the country, particularly in environmental groups, to put a moratorium on the construction of new nuclear power plants until we could develop safety protocols and a way to dispose of waste, which at that time, they literally just put it in the landfills, buried it underground a few feet. Now we've developed some better techniques for long-term disposal. Oh, there's still no permanent safe disposal method. And the safety protocols have been advanced, still not completely safe, but much safer. My local congressperson called me up and said, Larry, we'd like to get support for our moratorium petition. Would you, as president of the Penn Environmental Law Group, help us lead the way? I said, sure. I started with my own group at Penn Law, called an emergency meeting of the 40 members of our environmental law group. We got together. They all knew what it was about. I gave the explanation and the argument for why we should all sign the petition, and our group should be one of the leading supporters of this moratorium. No sooner did I finish and say, who's ready to sign? Somebody raised their hand and said, I'd like to speak. So a young law student came up, and he began to talk about business interests, the need for nuclear power, and how taking nuclear power away would increase our dependence on foreign oil, it would hurt business interests, and that we needed to push ahead regardless of the potential environmental impact, because the impact on the business community was far greater than what minor damage had been done to the environment. And that was the day that I woke up and realized that at least half the world, or half of those here in America, cared more about dollars and cents in business than the environment. Yeah. I was shocked to learn that I was the head of an environmental law group, and half of those law students, more than half it turns out, were destined to work for big corporations and defend corporate America against claims for damaging the environment. So they wanted to be environmental lawyers, not to protect the environment, but to deal with regulation and how to get around it. Needless to say, the vote on the petition failed, and we did not support the moratorium. That led me to be ever the more motivated to be who I was and to take steps and to pursue a career path that would in some way defend the environment against pollution and toxic exposures.
David and the Goliath for the environment. That's Mr. Cohan here. Well, yeah, it's no shock and it's no secret that this country is a capitalist focused group in society, but we always need that other group that has that sound of reason of being like, hey guys, this is important. If we want a future for our families and the next generations, we need to take care of this. It's always the balance, right? Yeah.
Tragically, the word hasn't completely gotten out, and people are still influenced by money and politics come to the conclusion that the environment is something that is not to be cherished or protected.
Yeah, totally. It's an afterthought. For sure. So your legal career is not only very, very interesting and extraordinary, but your involvement in numerous of these complex cases, you're, like you just said, often served as a pioneer in the field of this. Can you share a specific case or moment that ignited your passion for doing this justice and pursuing the boundaries environmental and vaccine law?
Well, I would say honestly that case after case gets me passionate. I first was asked in a long time ago as part of this Penn Environmental Law Group by the Public Interest Law Center of Philadelphia to investigate the dangers of asbestos in schools in Philadelphia. We learned, and this is before they were taking asbestos out, before the public was aware of the problem, we learned very quickly that asbestos was in every school in America built before 1978. Tons of it, massive, quantities of it. And children and teachers were all being exposed to it. And we wrote a passionate report to the Philadelphia School Board recommending that they take steps immediately to remove all asbestos. And they actually declined the invitation. And eventually they developed a program to encapsulate it, put drop ceilings in, put a floor on top of the floor, cover the pipe covering rather than remove it. And now here we are 40 plus years later, and schools all over America are getting sued. People are developing mesothelioma in those schools, and now they're being forced to spend the money to take it all out properly. Some of that was done in the 80s and 90s, but not nearly across the board. And that probably ignited my passion. I ended up clerking for a judge. It was the first asbestos judge in America. He actually appointed as the asbestos judge for Pennsylvania. We tried one of the very first cases in the country that I got to sit through. And I was fortunate enough to find a couple of other plaintiff's lawyers that were willing to let me open up a toxic tort department, which was my passion. And I said to them, I want to handle these chemical exposure and asbestos cases. And they said, yeah, sure, kid. And of course, that practice turned out to be very, very big, very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
3 months into private practice with my brand new law firm, I got a phone call from a woman who had met my mom in the supermarket. That's how I got my first big case.
Wow. Thanks, Mom.
Yeah, Mom knew what I was doing. And she cried on my mother's shoulders that her husband was dying from some strange disease caused by asbestos. My mother gave her my name. She called me. And of course, they were a lovely couple. They were in their 50s and he was dying from mesothelioma. And I got to meet my first mesothelioma victim in 1981. And it was extremely disturbing. And I represented that family successfully. It took several years. And that ignited my passion even more to represent victims of chemical exposure. And of course, that has gone on and on and on. If you'd like, I can tell you in the modern era, the PFAS litigation, which you mentioned earlier, which I've now been involved in for about 7 years. You know, there's an MDL, multi-district litigation, national case. PFAS is the forever chemical that it's in everybody's water. Mm-hmm. It is highly carcinogenic. It comes from firefighting foam. It's in your Teflon pans, by the way. Throw out your Teflon pans. Go to your local Home Depot or wherever you shop, you know, Costco, and for $149, get a new set of stick pans that have a different component, and they're non-stick pans that have no PFAS in them. Everybody in America should be doing that now. The box will say no PFAS. So I read in the newspaper.
I know that we still have that as an option for people to buy. Like, this will kill you, buy it.
Yeah, exactly. And there are still PFAS pans being sold. And it's remarkable that the pans now say non-PFAS containing. And I'll venture a bet that the vast majority, if not almost everybody who looks at that, has no idea what it means.
No, you're right.
Right now, it's the single largest carcinogenic component in America's drinking water. Almost everybody now has it in their blood. It's pervasive, ubiquitous, and non-biodegradable. So I learned about this in about 1915, 1916, and I found out that one of our local water providers just outside of Philadelphia in an affluent suburban community had tested their water, and it had over 1,000 parts per trillion of PFAS, which is an enormous amount. And they shut down the water supply. The neighboring two communities shut down their water supplies. Over 100,000 homes had to pipe their water in, and nobody was doing anything about it. And I literally called them up and asked for a meeting. And I said to them, you know, you need counsel. Somebody has contaminated your water, And at that point, we already began to realize it was coming off the military bases where they were using the firefighting foe. And that litigation has been a passion of mine ever since then. And there are a group of tremendous lawyers that are pursuing attempts to get compensation from the chemical companies that made the PFAS, those put it in their products and sold it. It is catastrophic. And unfortunately, it's going to take decades to clean up the problem. There's a movie, by the way, called Dark Waters.
Yes.
Mark Ruffalo, Anne Hathaway, that everybody should watch. It's very entertaining.
Mm-hmm.
Tells the story of Rob Ballot, who was the attorney who first learned about the PFAS problem, brought it to the attention of the legal system, and eventually here we are today. And at least the legal world knows about it. The average citizen still doesn't.
Mm-hmm. That movie I watched with my family, and like, to explain to them what I do work.
Yeah.
And understand it before they watch that movie. Like, see, this is what I do.
Yeah. And look, if you're finding victims of PFAS, mm-hmm. they're doing them a tremendous service because
oh my gosh,
they don't even know. Most people don't even know. They get a little suspicion that maybe they're a victim. They get a blood test that's positive. They find out that their local water is contaminated. They need help. They don't know where to turn. And we can help.
Even though the marketing world is so crazy and insane, and the amount of commercials and advertisements can, you know, get exhausting, flip side of the coin, they really are saving people's lives because they are informing people, you know, if you use this and you have this, there might be a good connection here. And, you know, just the more soon that people can get exposed to that, the more that they can react to it and maybe have the potential to save their life or have a better outcome of life in the long run.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, on that point, and it brings us to another subject matter that I know is near and dear to our hearts, and that's Camp Lejeune.
Yes.
You know, many people, particularly lawyers, would say to me, you know, all these ads on TV, you know, these lawyers trying to make money, Camp Lejeune, what is this nonsense?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I found it a little bit disturbing because people didn't understand.
Yeah.
And if they didn't live or work there, they had no appreciation for how badly contaminated it was.
Yeah.
And as you know, the bill that Congress passed gave us 2 years to find all of the victims across the country, mm-hmm. file claims, and get compensation for them and their families for birth defects, babies that died, brain cancers, you know, all of the potential carcinogens that are all over Camp Lejeune.
It's a disturbing list.
It's a disturbing list of chemicals and diseases. And those ads, while yes, there are lawyers and there's a business side of the law, they are legitimately attempting, and we are, to find the victims, make claims for them, and get compensation for them and their families. They were wronged.
Yep.
So it's a process that nobody is going to drive this process of cleaning up the environment and getting something for those who were wrongly exposed to toxins, other than the lawyers and those who support us and help us drive the business side of the practice of law. So I appreciate your point. Well,
yeah.
I agree.
Of course. And I might be so bold to say that without your group, without these attorneys, I don't think the government would have done anything about it.
We know that to be true. Absolutely.
It's
true of, you know,
which
asbestos.
Yeah.
The oldest mass tort in the country, had lawyers not begun to drive that process and file claims for individuals, you know, 40 years ago, we had to prove that mesothelioma was caused by asbestos. They were denying it for the first decade. And it's true in all of these other chemical exposures, toxic torts. It's true when you get beyond that into other products and pharmaceuticals. You know, my passion is the chemicals and the toxins in our environment. Because they're so subtle, most of them cannot be seen.
Mm-hmm.
People don't understand how they work and that we have a toxic burden in our bodies. There are many things, and I don't want to get too far afield, that are still unanswered questions, like why we have so many more cancers. Why is the rate of autism growing, and not just as a measure of testing, but the number of cases? Why are there new types of cancers that are booming in numbers? I'm pretty confident that it's the toxic content in our environment.
Why are North America's numbers so much higher than other parts of the world?
Exactly. Another great question.
Exactly. So now I would like to shift the conversation into vaccine law, because this is an area of your practice that you also pioneer. Something that's not really discussed a lot or doesn't have a headline on it. So in your expertise in representing victims of rare vaccine injuries, can you explain to us what this area of law looks like?
Sure. It is a complex area of law,
mm-hmm.
Fraught with problems, confusion, misinformation. But here's the little known fact that I know, and I believe you know. There is a vaccine court in America. It's housed in the Federal Claims Court in Washington, D.C. We have 8 full-time judges, and they hear cases all day, every day, from victims of vaccines that have had a vaccination and an adverse reaction. And there is a fund with $4.5 billion sitting in it that is paying out about $400 million a year to victims of vaccines around the country. That fund is created because every American, every time they're vaccinated, 75 cents out of that vaccination cost is paid into the fund. And I don't know if you knew all that. You don't
have to. I didn't.
I will tell you that 99%+ of all lawyers don't even know this court exists. The average American doesn't know it. And it's unfortunate. And just a little bit of history. In the 1970s, there was a swine flu.
Mm-hmm.
And the swine flu was a sort of a pandemic like we just had with COVID. And they developed a vaccine. And what they noticed was that there was an uptick in the number of cases of Guillain-Barré syndrome, or GBS, a central nervous system disorder, in the people that had received the vaccination. And there were a lot of lawsuits. Very few people got compensated. But the vaccine manufacturers were sued right and left. It was still almost impossible to prove that the vaccine caused your GBS, because GBS is caused by every kind of virus, bacterial infection known to man. When your immune system reacts to an insult, it can misfire sometimes and cause a bigger problem than the one you had. So what happened was the vaccine companies, the manufacturers, pharmaceutical companies, the insurance industry, the courts, Congress, and even the plaintiffs bar got together and said, you know what? We need vaccines. We can't drive these companies out of the vaccine business. We want to encourage them to be here to continue to develop new vaccines. So they created the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program. They began with a small investment by Congress and then the tax on vaccination to create the fund. And in 1986, the vaccine court opened up in Washington, D.C. So we're approaching the 40-year mark in 2 years.
Wow.
That this court has been in existence. They hear almost every kind of vaccine claim, and I can get into more detail, but I encourage those interested to read about it. Lawyers need to read about it and understand it. I often lecture to trial lawyers associations, American Association of Justice, and even doctor groups. And the first question I ask is, who here thinks that there's actually a court dedicated to vaccines? And usually the answer is one hand goes up. That's my associate who I brought with me, who helps me on cases. And then I'll say to people, and particularly doctor groups, who here believes that vaccines can actually cause an adverse reaction, other than a sore arm and an achy arm? I mean, serious reactions. And in the doctor communities, no hands go up, because doctors are taught in medical school that vaccines do not cause any serious adverse reaction, that they are harmless. In the general population, remarkably, a lot of hands go up, and we have our anti-vaxxers who are completely against vaccination. So then the question becomes, what's the truth? As always, the truth lies somewhere in between, but statistically, I will tell you that the risk of a serious injury from a vaccination is, for most vaccinations, 1 in 1,000,000. The risk of dying from diseases like chickenpox, smallpox, polio, COVID, and other diseases is many times that amount. So the risk-benefit analysis makes it very clear that you want to get vaccinations for every recommended vaccination there is. I mean, there's some vaccinations that have not yet been recommended by the AMA. They're on trial basis. But if it's been recommended and time-tested, or if it's part of solving a major social problem like a pandemic, you need to get them. Vaccines themselves are essentially harmless. And we'll talk about what we hear and read on the internet in a minute. The reality is that a rare individual gets a vaccination, and in the vaccination, there's something called an adjuvant. It wakes up the system. Your immune system says, oh, there's an invader. We're going to go attack. And the immune system recognizes that invader. It's a tiny little insult. They knock it out, and now they have permanent memory. So when it comes back, they can knock it out again. That's how vaccines work. Vaccines are minuscule quantities of a condition, almost never enough to cause any harm. The human immune system, like every part of us, is not quite perfect. And sometimes the immune system fires and they miss. And instead of hitting the offending agent that they're supposed to learn about, they'll hit the spinal cord, the central nervous system, the brain, the blood system. You know, it can happen. It's a 1 in 1,000,000 occurrence. And the last point I'll make medically is the study of epidemiology is the statistics of science and medicine. There is no epidemiologic proof that any vaccine causes any injury. And I admit there are a few exceptions, like you can hurt your shoulder with the vaccine. There's some epidemiology on that. But disease-wise, nothing. What we're reading about now, unfortunately, and I say reading, and I'm being kind to chatter on the internet, chat rooms and
the Karens.
Yes, it is. It's unfortunate because most of those folks have no concept of the science or the medicine. A temporal relationship between vaccination and injury means very little. So, for example, GBS, this condition I mentioned, you know, it happens tens of thousands of times a year across America, randomly, any day of the year. Well, statistically, somebody's going to get a vaccine and 10 days later, they're going to get GBS. That GBS may have been caused by the cold they had 2 weeks prior, because it only takes a mild infection to cause the body to overreact and create an immune called an immune-mediated disorder. And many of the immune-mediated disorders are caused by the body misfiring. And we all know about many of lupus and MS and others that we don't really know the cause of. A vaccine is not the actual direct cause. It can be a trigger, and it's one of many. There's no demonstrable proof that the COVID vaccine is causing anything specifically. Now, they're studying that one issue right now, the COVID vaccine in teens causing a blood clot, because they've had more than what you would expect. Those studies are not released yet. We don't know about them. And that was an old variant of the vaccine. That's not the one we're seeing now.
Yeah.
So
all of this vaping that this young generation
needs to. Exactly. It could be vaping, among many other things the younger generation does. I include myself and you among that generation.
Eat Tide Pods. I'm not part of that generation.
Exactly. It could be a lot of things like that. So, you know, I would urge people to, if you're going to read peer-reviewed literature.
Mm-hmm.
Read about what actual doctors who were studying the issues are having to say. You know, there was this drug, ivermectin, that was recommended by the then president for COVID. Ivermectin, and then the internet chatter began, and there was a great outcry that we should be allowed to use ivermectin. You know, it's a medication for animals, and it has no efficacy for COVID. In fact, in humans, it has huge adverse effects, well documented. And here we are now 3 years later, and some of the doctors who prescribed ivermectin have had their licenses taken away. The drug is absolutely demonstrated to be harmful to humans in every respect. And people listened to the chatter on the internet and went ahead and bought the drug, took it. We really need to approach vaccines in a sensible way. They save lives. They help improve health by the millions, and the risks are small. And I don't want to be so foolish as to say they're non-existent. There wouldn't be a court if they were non-existent. But here's the last legal point I'll make, and you can ask me your next question. Mm-hmm. In the vaccine court, we don't have to show epidemiology. We don't even have to prove legal causation, meaning that it's more likely than not the vaccine that caused it. Because we can't do that. Nobody can. There's no proof of vaccines causing these diseases. We only have to show that there's a theory that has some plausibility that might explain a connection. In other words, the burden of proof is so light. The object of that court, and I'm bringing it back full circle to where we began this, the object of that court is to give compensation to people who might have a reaction to a vaccine and pay them well so that they don't have to burden the legal system. The vaccine manufacturers have been given immunity from suit across the country. They are essentially immune from suit, and it encourages them to research, spend money, produce new medications, new vaccines that will be helpful eradicating disease. And the program has worked.
Mm-hmm.
Vaccine manufacturers are in business, they make money, and they continue to spend billions on research.
Mm. Yeah. Well, thank you for going and explaining that, the points that you did. I think you answered my next question, really, with the misinformation that's going on. And it really is a growing concern. And I think you did bring up some point for some legal consequences for spreading false information with the ivermectin. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Ivermectin, yeah.
Ivermectin, yeah. So I think that's a great example. But to be respectful of your time, I would like to move on to some of these other cases that you've gone through throughout your career. You've taken on cases involving corporate drugs, complex legal battles. What motivates you to advocate for the underdog and fight against these powerful entities for the pursuit of really justice?
Well, it's a combination of what I've already said, and that is, you know, my passion to have a clean planet. Mm-hmm. And we are so loaded with toxins, and people are the victims.
Yeah.
Our water, our air. So I'm motivated by that to be a small player in fighting back against that. And of course, you know, I love people, and I respect them, and they need help. And the average person can't even begin to represent themselves or to fight a big corporation. I have been blessed with a good education and a great law firm and partners that are willing to spend money and invest and have allowed me to do what I need to do. And I love the work. I love representing people. I love getting them what they deserve. And it's, you know, blessed to have such a great career and work in a great profession. So it's actually easy for me to wake up in the morning and want to come to the office and fight the fight.
Yeah, you can see the passion that you have for this. It illuminates you. But, you know, fighting against Goliath is very exhausting. You must need balance in this whole thing. So I understand you are a yoga teacher. You've been practicing this for, you know, close to 40 years, if I remember correctly. Maybe 50, but I don't want to date you.
I'm dated. I think I've already given it away in this conversation today. 50.
50 years of being a yoga teacher. So why don't you share with that kind of what that balance looks like between yoga, law, and share with us about yoga practice. How did you come to find and love yoga?
I was very lucky. You know, when I was growing up, you know, it was the early age of the hippies. And, and one of my best buddies' moms was a suburban housewife who became a hippie.
Love it.
She studied yoga. She went to India, studied yoga, came back and taught yoga in the living room, mostly to housewives in the neighborhood. But she invited her kids and their friends. And I came, I watched, and I was fascinated. I went away to college in Boston, and they had yoga for one credit. And I began to study yoga at the university as part of a school program. Turns out my teacher was an Iyengar, who's the master yogi who really brought yoga in large part to America. And I studied with her for 3 years. She had to go out for medical reasons. And back then, they didn't have certifications. And she said to me, "Larry, I need a teacher to take my place," which is how they did it in the old days. And I began to teach her classes at Boston University for credit and money. And also, you know, my passion grew, because when you teach something, you are practicing while you teach. And your learning deepens every time you teach. And I became even more passionate about it. And my teacher at that time challenged me and said, you know, a practice of anything you do in life is something that you'd stay with forever. It doesn't have a beginning and an end. You don't go into health for a year. You don't go into a good diet for a year. These are things you commit to for life. So I made a commitment, and I became more and more passionate about it and fell in love with it. And then when I got into law and the stress and the hours, I began to realize that this was a tremendous balance, practicing and teaching yoga while practicing law, because I get regular fitness. We do breath work. We meditate. We practice mindfulness. We're in the moment. You know, so it keeps me from being distracted, worrying about yesterday and tomorrow. Although I think about those things and worry like everybody else, we learn in yoga that tape that rolls through all of our minds all day long, one that keeps us up in the middle of the night when we wake up and start thinking about something. How do we control our own mind? How do we come back to the moment? How many times can that tape control us? And yoga for me has been a tool to learn how to find balance, focus, physical strength. So I have practiced continually and taught and continue to do so.
Take us more deeper into what that mindfulness looks like, you know, as an attorney, but then also in terms with your client relationships?
Well, it helps one stay centered. So mindfulness is a, you know, it's a broad term, and there are mindfulness programs of all kinds, and I recommend all of them to everybody. Most of us have a difficult time staying centered. We worry. Our mind is in somewhere else. We're here dealing with people. So for me, when I have a client in the room with me, or the modern era in the Zoom meeting, I'm with the client. You know, I've learned to be present. Now, it's true in relationship, in life, with family and friends, but it's nowhere, you know, it just is true in work and in the law, dealing with clients, dealing with judges, really important, dealing with juries, being able to be present for them, stay with them, tell them the truth, look them in the eye. And that all comes out of mindfulness, to be able to do that and not be distracted. And, you know, there's some anxiety in what we do, but taking that anxiety and using it in a centered way as motivational anxiety, rather than something that brings you down, freaks you out, makes you not be able to sleep at night. So, you know, it fits together nicely, mindfulness and the law practice. And, you know, people will say, you know, oh, Larry's so calm. You know, I am. And I'm not any less thoughtful or any less concerned than any other lawyer facing that difficult case and that corporate behemoth that polluted our environment, or any more pissed off or less pissed off than somebody else who really cares. But getting all over the place rather than staying focused and centered is going to get you nowhere. So it's what mindfulness is about. One of the things that we practice in yoga practice, and I brought it to my law practice and to who I am.
That's beautiful. It's definitely something, if you know Larry personally, it's just a different, it's a different energy that you have when you're talking with you, have conversations with you, compared with a lot of people that I feel is this, I can relax my shoulders. And, you know, you really do feel that you are giving me your total, complete, undivided attention. And that just makes somebody feel so much more heard and seen. And I can totally see how that can convert so beautifully, not just in relationships, but in a courtroom, to juries, to your peers, to defense counsel. And it just drops shoulders and it makes people feel seen.
Very well said. I really like how you just characterized it.
I think we've known each other now for 3 years. 3 years, I want to say. And it's just been that's been the consistency that I've had with my encounters with you. Even when
that's mutual. It's mutual, so you're doing something right as well.
Yeah, and it's true when we've had to have, you know, difficult conversations, complex conversations, fun conversations. And I respect you and I value, I just value what you give to me and our relationship. So,
but that's mutual. And I would add this one thought. You just raised a really good point. Being a yogi, being mindful, doesn't mean that you're afraid to avoid, that you're afraid of confrontation. It doesn't mean that you avoid the complexities of life and all the conflict that it brings. It means that you hit it head on, eyes open.
Yeah.
And you have to, obviously, in what I do as a lawyer. So contrary to a myth, you know, that yogis have to sit and chant and withdraw from the world, it's absolutely not true. And yoga practice and mindfulness makes you more part of the world. Makes being in the world a little bit easier.
Yeah. And I loved how you articulated it, using all that anxiety, channeling it, and pushing in a direct and forward motion. And that anxiety, when you really break it down, anxiety just means that you're fearful of the future, right? And so when you take a lot of the things that you practice in mindfulness, I'm comparing your mindfulness practice to my, you know, faith practice. You don't need to have anxieties about anything because we know that we're going to be taken care of. And it, you know, what is and what will be, right?
So absolutely.
You've blessed me with an hour of your time, and I know that you're very high in demand and a busy man. So thank you so much. Guys, if you have reached the end of this show and you're still listening, thank you from the bottom of my heart. And if you found value in this show, please share it. It's a long way for the podcast. And don't forget to subscribe to the show as well. All right. Thank you so much for your time, Larry, Mr. Cohan.
Thank you, Amy.
We didn't go through your last name story. We will next time.
Great. Thanks for the questions and the time. I appreciate it.
Of course, Sarah. We'll talk soon.